It's good to talk to you. I didn't expect quite so soon to be beginning a course again from my recording booth overlooking the Hudson River. We may have some hope that before too long we will be seeing one another face to face in the theater, as we should be when we try to have dialogue using actual spoken words. I'm not entirely convinced that we will be together next week as declared and fervently assured once tuition becomes non-refundable and Omicron has failed to go away. I think we may find ourselves with another school of thought about all that. But it is not for us just yet to question the commitment of the powers that be to mutually endanger us next week. I am, I believe, the only one of us who is about to turn 63 years old, and I have been severely asthmatic since I was 12 years old, so if anybody's going to die, you should be reassured that I'm almost surely the designated casualty. But whatever may be the outcome of the balance between quality education and quality occupational safety and health, next week, this week, here we are, and I am trying to do the best that I can without actually seeing you. You know from your experience of Zoom school why it is that I don't use it, or at least you know part of why it is that I don't use it. But we might just want to account momentarily for how we are coming together this week. When we are gathered together as we should be, a variety of things are going on all at once, as they always are. And as lawyers, we must be of many minds and keep track of many of the things that are going on. But one of the most important elements in that process, so important indeed that it is the second law of social psychology for lawyers that we will occasionally rely upon in our conversation, the second rule of social psychology for lawyers is that hominid primates believe what they see and they imagine what they hear. We are primarily visual animals and diurnal ones. That is, we work using eyesight in the daytime. And we were doing that before we and our closest living cousins, the chimpanzee and the bonobo, and we were all joined in one common stock of daytime living, eyesight dependent, amazing hominid creatures. But in the nighttime, our primary sense fails us. And in order to stay alive in the nighttime, we do something that is far more doubtful to us. What we see in daylight with our own eyes, as we say, we trust. Our relationship cognitively to our cognitive sense of vision involves an innermost trust in the body's ability to know, which we lack in the dark. Those of us, at any rate, who grow up capable physiologically to depend upon eyesight, our nervous systems are a miracle of adaptability. But those of us who can see in the light must imagine in the dark. We are constantly calculating what we hear, trying to interpret it, to understand what is rustling in the underbrush or moving about downstairs. We surmise, we test, we consider, but mostly we imagine in the hope of finding the key imagination that fits the lock, which is our need to understand. Because we do this with the understanding that our emotions are deeply and importantly engaged, we do this also when we are hearing not just the sounds of potential threat, but the wonderful effort to reach our interpretive imaginations, which is our music, the music we have always played to one another and we always will. In our ears is our imagination. This is why the great genius, the agoraphobic radio producer Tony Schwartz, who more than anybody else made the North American continent a no-smoking zone. Tony said once that radio is powerful because people are born without earlids. We filter what we see because we trust it, and we imagine what we hear, and we throw ourselves open to it. And so if we must meet virtually, if we must have our conversation interrupted by space and the breakage of time, which is Zoom school, or at any rate, which is virtual instruction, whether in Zoom school or not, we will use imagination. I will try to come before you to your ear. When we are in the theater, we do that and we see one another and we trust the experience we are having more. When we are looking at little heads in tiny boxes, however, we trust that we do not understand and we stop listening carefully and our imaginations are shut off. And Zoom school is a place where nothing is real and nothing is trustworthy and nothing sponsors or stimulates our imagination, and therefore, well, really, no learning goes on. So if we can meet face-to-face in the theater of Jerome Green Hall 105 without endangering our lives or sacrificing all sense of future medical possibility, if we can meet there, we will listen and we will see at the same time. We will not record. I do not record what happens in our theater, and by being there, you have agreed that you do not record it either. It's live, off the record, a real conversation occurring despite the 21st century's effort to surveil everything. Privacy in education is an important part of what I think about and do, and so from time to time you will hear me wasting your time, at least if it's not something you might do yourself as a lawyer one day, you will hear me wasting your time speculating about what is happening to the process of learning as we turn it always, whether through Courseworks or Echo 360 or in some other benighted technological way. I am no enemy of technology, you know, and will know more soon of, but I am the enemy of benighted technology, the technology of the king of the undead and the others of the dark. And I am in favor of the freedom of the mind, and that means that I do not like making recordings of what, from our point of view, should be the thing that happens when we are together. If you miss it, it didn't occur. Don't worry, we can have a very satisfactory time making a kind of course in which that experience is missed. Maybe for all of us, maybe for some of us if we get sick, maybe for almost all of us if I get sick. But provided that we're well, we will rely upon the reality of eye to eye and ear to ear and, well, voice-to-voice relationship. The essence of what we do together is captured then not in a recording of our voices, not under ordinary circumstances, unless I must stand here looking down the Hudson River into the space between the history of New York and the history of New Jersey, on which I spent so much of my youth. We will not depend upon recording what we say to one another. We will depend upon writing down what we think. If we must use virtual instruction, we will write down what we think on a pad together, shared among all of us, rather than meeting on Zoom. We will use language with one another. We will write back and forth. But even if we are together in these periods on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, still we will write down what we think, and we will put it in the wiki, the form of shared web space which actually works, as opposed to all the forms of crap technology with which you are so well acquainted, and the primary purpose of which is to make you fill out forms. Wikis, as you know, because you use Wikipedia all the time to conduct research, and maybe you have become an editor and also you help to organize and teach there. Wikipedia is an example of the way that wikis are used at the largest of scales. Ours is a small one involving us and some people who have taken this course before and who like to drop in from time to time and see what's published by the people taking it. Wikis are a way of communicating by freeform writing, not filling out forms, not adding to databases, but making text. Some of that writing is the formal work of this course. Two essays, never more than 1,000 words under any circumstances, in at least two drafts. Two essays, never more than 1,000 words, in at least two drafts. We write and revise. You make the decision about what you write about, and we make the decision together how to make what you have written better. We have that experience twice, and that's the official work of the course. There is no exam. This is about creativity. Our form of evaluation has to assume that we are creating together and that you are responsible for what, and together we are responsible for how. All sorts of other writing can occur in the same way in this wiki. If you have a comment or a question or a suggestion about something to read or an idea you want to bat around, then that's a new topic, and you press the button and you say in a wiki title what your new topic is, and off we go. Sometimes there will be conversations started by me in that fashion, but mostly the conversations in that fashion will be started by you. I decide what we talk about when we are in the theater, after all. What we read in order to back our conversation, I will decide in a free-form way. There are many dozens of things I sometimes find useful in this conversation to drag in, and a very few things that I think every single year there's something useful to be taken from. Later, when I am no longer talking about procedure and I'm talking about substance, which is what on anything other than the first day you'd always want to be talking about, later we shall see that those readings are devised for some particular purposes. That is to say, the purposes are always particular. The readings are, well, variably particular, and I'll decide from moment to moment as we go along, but not just me, because the new topic button's always there, and you can always push it and write something down and see what kind of a conversation you can get started. And if a conversation has gotten started to the point at which most people want to follow it, then we should bring it into the room and talk about it eye to eye and voice to voice. So the wiki then becomes not just the place in which our reading is, so that we don't buy books or have to go to pick up an unnecessary Netflix subscription, although if you have a Netflix subscription sometimes, then what we are going to talk about together you can find there. And not just what we write in a formal way in order to make the occupation happy with the level at which you got a good grade, but also all the other things that come up, and not just now, but possibly later, and maybe somebody will decide at the end of the term that there is something to be talked about beyond the space of the semester, and that's always more than welcome. So here is a wiki in which things can be written and ways that we can share our writing, both formally and informally, both just share between you and me and also share with just the class and also share with all the world. And all of those forms of writing are part of our practice because we have a practice, all of us, each of us. Have practices in this class, if nowhere else, we recognize that you have, from the moment you come to law school, a practice. What it means to have a practice, what it means to have a practice is what it means to be a lawyer, and what it means to be a lawyer is actually the true substance of this course. The other thing that I have to say on the first day before we can go back to what we would say on the first day if only we were together saying it to one another, the only other thing I need to say on the first day is that this course is evaluated, and I have demanded of you without fail that you should read the evaluation policy. The reason that I demand of you that you read the evaluation policy is that in almost every law school course there is one and you can't read it because nobody really would want to have to explain how the occupation works because the occupation, that is the system of evaluation that we call grades, like most occupations, is at root both greedy and irrational, both unjustifiable and arbitrarily oppressive, not by accident, but because that is the way that occupations work. You will tire, I promise you will tire, not the most chaotic, nor the most anal retentive, nor the most passive-aggressive, nor the most open-handed and profound thinking of you. Everybody, I promise, will get very tired of me pointing out that there is absolutely nothing relevant to anything about grades. I will say this now and then and always and years from now if you keep taking my courses and I keep living, because it will continue always to be true and it will be always unbelievable. When we come to the first law of social psychology for lawyers, we shall think in a more precise way about why that is. But for the moment, I need only to say that there is no purpose in grades. They're meaningless, and caring about them is truly pointless. You are told, of course, that they are of practical significance, that the grades you get are somehow related to what you are allowed or encouraged or able to do in the world, and all of that is nonsense, too. But for the moment, what we need to concentrate on, because I am compelled to make you read an evaluation policy so we don't have to keep talking about it, is that the grades that we are given are really burdens we are hobbled by, unless they are responsive to some understanding of how those evaluations can help you learn better and enjoy learning more. And there is simply nothing that something can do for you along those lines if it is merely whipped up and pushed into you at the period some weeks after the end of our time together. So the evaluation policy of a course should be to evaluate things that a student and a teacher can both agree are there on a basis which is continuous and allows both student and teacher to know better what is going on in learning than would be true if the policy of evaluation weren't in effect. That's a tall order, and I don't actually believe that most means or even any means of evaluation achieve that goal for every teacher and every student all the time. I don't even think they do it very well much when they are thought about as long and hard as they can be, as my policy has been. 35 years of living with the occupation and increasingly being unwilling to wear its uniform have led me where I am. We are constantly evaluating your level of effort, your level of commitment to your own learning and to the group in which you are learning, and the level of improvement that from moment to moment and project to project, and draft to draft and class to class, you are showing in the ability you have to learn and in your ability to pass that learning along. Because to be a lawyer is far more to be a teacher than to be a student. There's learning going on for the lawyer all the time, but there's another purpose to that lawyering always. The lawyer is not learning for art's sake, but for the sake of what can be done. So that's our procedure, why we meet the way we meet, whatever we way of meeting the epidemic will allow to us, how we proceed to discuss and to memorialize but not record what it is that we discuss, how we generate the reading and the topics that we take up, how the wiki works. Well, we shall see a lot more about that as we go, but why it is that we are using it and this and other forms of technology that aren't low-quality, mass-market, commodity video conferencing. Well, anyway. It might be that we can only, let us say, 20% of the way into our acquaintance, put procedural matters aside, therefore, and think about what it is that is the substance of what we do. The substance of what we do, I will say, includes doubting that there is a distinction for a lawyer in the end between procedure and substance, but like the Niels Bohr model of the hydrogen atom, it's a useful, if somewhat deceptive, reductive illustration. And so let us move from procedure to substance, as though that was actually a movement. What is this course about? This course has two related subjects, the first of which is how to be creative in law school, and the second is how to be creative in thinking during and after law school about one's career, one's life in the law, one's lawyering. These subjects are joined, obviously, by the property of creativity, whatever the hell that is, and that is, of course, what we are thinking about one way or another pretty much all the time. And they are joined by the fact that this thing called law school is the place in which people's attitudes about their careers, their lives in the law, their lawyering are generated, and it is my submission to you and the reason that this course exists and that I have spent 3.5 decades either planning it or teaching it or defending it or changing it or camouflaging it so it can continue to exist and be delivered, I submit to you that the way that law school, generally speaking, presently existing law school, even the best of American law school, which is as good as law school gets anywhere in the human race, law school does a terribly failful job, full of reductiveness and anti-creativity and all that can be said about the lapsus logici of its material relation to your future, the contributions it means to get from you and what they will be. Law school does a horrific job of helping people to think about how to be the kinds of lawyers who will be happy in the law. You meet now unhappy law students, and you meet when you are out and about unhappy lawyers in law firms, and you write about the things you want to be, and you write about the things that you are coming to believe as you go through law school you are compelled to be instead, and you follow in the tracks of many unhappy people. I started teaching law school full-time in the summer of 1987, and I have taught law school full-time except on those momentary spots when I was on leave ever since. I have taught more than 6,000 law students, and in the course of time, the great majority of them wound up unhappy and ill-suited by the careers that they had made or chosen or had chosen or made for them. And this is why I have long since stopped turning the crank on the bullshit machine. But that doesn't mean that law school can't be the place where people learn how to be lawyers of a kind that will make them happy and productive and help the society in which they live. If there is any such place in the human world at all, it must be law school. And that means that we have to fix the way that law school teaches people to think about lawyering. And this course and the course I call Planning Your Practice are courses designed to be part of the fix instead of part of the fixlessness and the problem. So if you can create ideas in law school about law, then the works of your creation will make you learn more, involve your learning more, create more happiness in you about learning, and give you insight into how to find ways to be a lawyer that will be good for you. Also, vaccination. Inoculation against the system of reduction which turns brilliant young people into canned meat to be packed inside cans, inside cases, inside, on top of pallets, in the back of trucks, delivering canned meat to the canned meat purchasers who are both the law school's biggest employer functionaries and its donors. We are, of course, benefiting from a system. You have, I have, you will, I will, for as long as I have left, be beneficiaries of a system. It has chosen to empower you. But that doesn't mean it has chosen to empower you for your happiness or well-being. It doesn't mean that your happiness and well-being will be the system's primary concern. If you are, however, a good lawyer, you can make it work for you. This course isn't contracts. It isn't torts. Well, it's not any of those things because, among other differences, we refuse ever, almost ever, to read cases or statutes or any of the formal ordinary materials of the course. I admit that there will be breakdowns in that commitment. In fact, I have one immediate departure in mind in the next few days. But mostly we read about ideas concerning the legal system and about the lawyers who work in it. And we take in those ideas and we use them as our paints and canvas, our clay, our ruled paper. We want to make things of the ideas we come across. We want to make new things, new ideas, new conceptions, new arguments to put in the blue books at the ends of other courses. We want to make things that will simply show up in class and stop traffic. We want to make things that will show new ways of finding justice and of doing what it is that lawyers aspire to do, which is to make justice where justice previously was not. And we want to do all that in ways that produce ideas about how to make a living, how to live a life, how to have the necessary fortune and the necessary good fortune to live productively in the law and to enjoy, well, lawyering. We will not, as you will see as we go along, we will not be very interested in defining law here in this course. I'm sure that there are many good first-year law school courses in which defining law would be a good idea. It's hard to teach a property course, at least I found in my 12 years as a property teacher. It's hard to teach a property course to first-year students without spending an awful lot of time trying to figure out precisely what property is anyway. And if that's true, then surely that is also true in some sense about law as a quantity in law school, but we're not interested here. What we define here is lawyering, a social process in present declarative progressive, because lawyering is what lawyers are always going on. They're going on about lawyering when they are talking about it, and they're going on in lawyering when they are heading towards the elevator or up from the street or, I guess, God help them, into Zoom. Lawyering is what we need to understand, and if we are to understand it, then indeed we do need to define it precisely, and lawyering is precisely this. Lawyering is making something happen in society using words. When you are making something happen in society using words, you are lawyering. When you are blowing words into your mustache, as the Slavic idiom would have it, then you are not lawyering, because nothing is making its way into social life that you are putting there for a reason. Lawyers use words purposively when they speak them or they write them down or they whistle them in the street. Lawyers have a purpose in their words, and the purpose of those words is to make something happen in society, usually on behalf of an entity referred to as a client, but sometimes on behalf of an idea, a situation, or a social change, a purpose lent by the client or provided by the society has animated the lawyer to use words to make something happen. Lawyering is going on. If lawyering is going on, then the lawyer is in practice. Although at the moment you are barely useful to anybody, and you haven't a license, which is the promise by the state that you may join the collective monopoly of people entitled to solicit clients, although you haven't any of that, you are in practice now. You have come here and paid money and been told how smart you are over rubber chicken and whatever. And all of that puts you in practice. When you want to make something happen in society, you should use words. You should use words in the sense that using words in society, in a society like this one with at least a basic commitment to freedom of expression, shouldn't get you in too much trouble. But more importantly, of course, words work. Now, bullets work too, and Molotov cocktails and what have you, but they work poorly. They do collateral damage, they create pushback, they result in retaliation, they fail of their purpose, they achieve unintended consequences. Words land with precision, with purpose, and with effect. Lawyers' words do, anyway, and you are already in the business of mastering lawyers' words. You're in practice. You're an unlicensed practice. You're capable of the most frightful mistakes. You have all sorts of possibilities of, malpractice in your practice. But that's all right. You're learning. I run a teaching practice. I have run for 17 years a teaching practice, a 501c3 entity called the Software Freedom Law Center, which does a kind of law in which we will occasionally be glancingly interested, but this is not a course in which software or free software or the copyright and patent law of software or how anarchism actually gets turned into productive software that is worth trillions of dollars in the global economy. All of that is not our subject, and even though it's mine, I'm not mostly going to push it on you. But that practice is a teaching practice. That is to say that students work there, and young lawyers starting out work there. And together with my partner, Ms. Chaudhry, we try and make lawyers better. We teach them, which means, of course, that they make mistakes. Not as bad as the mistakes you make, because they've had a little more legal education than you've had, but all the kinds of mistakes that all of us made when we were young and our lawyering was fresh and new, they make there, and we correct them. A practice, then, isn't an act of perfection, the achievement of mastery and its infinite, we assume, prosperous reproduction. I mean, it is. That's what lawyers do. They figure out how to do a trick, and then they find as many people as they can who will pay them to do that trick, and they keep doing it until the trick's worn out. But that's because lawyers aren't creative in their nature. Law school isn't creative in its nature. In most of the forms of legal education in human society around the world, creativity is not advantageous. You don't get improved grades for it, to be blunt. The lawyer's job is to learn this mess of stuff, which represents the outstanding set of compromises between power, money, and the truth, and which it is the lawyer's job to understand how to operate, but almost never the lawyer's job to understand how intellectually to transcend. American law school is the way it is, and American law has been the way it has been for the last 125 years for some accidental reasons. Accidental in the sense that America is in itself, the United States, an accidental place. Intellectually, culturally, politically, an empire of good fortunes, contingent results, and of course, never paying too much attention to those whom one did down in order to make it. But American law school in the 20th century has been a place in which creativity was not punished in the same outright sense that it is punished, let us say, among those who are still learning as they were 2,000 years ago to admire the principles of the Roman law. Why the legal culture of the United States took a strange and different direction in the last years of the 19th century that came to be called legal realism, and what this meaning of legal realism implies for the way that we might be in learning law school, we shall pay some attention to, particularly in the next couple of weeks. As we get our conversation started, it is worth paying some attention to why it is that we have this conversation in this way. And the best place to start with that is with the essay 1897, written by a then Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. Well, that's why I asked you to read it. And on Thursday, when we are talking again in the current unilateral sort of way that we are talking, I will try to help you imagine why it is that the path of the law might be something that you would care about. But for the larger scale understanding of the substance of our course, sufficient it is for the day to say that at the end of the 19th century, American lawyers took an unusual intellectual step, which built itself over 20 years into a movement, which built itself over 30 more years into a mess of ways of seeing things about making stuff happen in society using words, which, if we recovered the contours of it, not all the detail, not every single part of the pathways of the history of ideas, but if we can get the hang of it, if we can make ourselves understand its chord progressions, if we can whistle it coming out of the theater, then we can use the particular intellectual vitality of the American lawyers of the first two-thirds of the 20th century to do something very 21st century indeed, which is to make ourselves creative legal thinkers under the unpropitious circumstances of the late epidemic United States. By doing so, in turn, we begin to understand what it would mean to have our own ideas about what to make happen in society using words, and how to use that happening to achieve what we might justifiably in our own inmost hearts call justice. So we are learning how to learn lawyering more creatively, and how, having been more creative about lawyering in the school, to become more creative about our particular lawyering in the world. My purpose, having spent 3 decades making this course and offering this course and failing to get it right and failing again better, my purpose is to initiate, to ignite, possibly even to instigate, the process by which you decide about your learning, how to do it better and enjoy it more for the purpose of becoming a better lawyer who has happiness to feel and justice to make and fortune to do both with. For that, the primary goal of our inquiry is what we might call a lawyer's theory of social action. What a lawyer wants for lawyering purposes is about any particular social process, which might be an arraignment, or might be a negotiation, or might be a divorce, or might be a marriage of any number of different kinds. What a lawyer wants is to be able to see the social process going on, whatever that thing may be, and to understand what might be done to it, might be modified, edited, distorted, collapsed, rebuilt, reimagined, revised, reformed, in a process which will leave the lawyer aware of the unrolling social process marked by the occasional slot entitled in the lawyer's blueprint, "Insert words here." We want to understand how things happen in society so that we can make them happen in society using words. In order to do that, we need a form of picture of society, not necessarily perfectly correct in its accurate details any more than Niels Bohr's hydrogen atom is perfectly correct about the way that electrons exist. We might miss a bunch of cloudiness and probability to be, well, almost precise, somewhat uncertain, aware of multiplicity and assured that it isn't always controllable. All subjects we need to investigate and need to investigate in several different ways. But still, the goal is to have a theory of how to understand social process and action as it stands before us. A goal not with understanding as its primary property, but effectiveness, malleability, getting things done. And so a lawyer's theory of social action isn't necessarily a sociologist's theory or a social psychologist's theory or a public health worker's theory of social action. And indeed, that's the whole point. It's none of those and all of those and many more. A lawyer is an eclectic social theorist because the quality of the theory isn't really what matters. What matters is what gets done. That's realism, you see. You see it in Holmes. It is, after all, the lawyer's job to predict the incidence of the public force, to understand where the hammer's going to fall, and to keep the client's thumb from being there. Therefore, our theory of social action is a theory which allows for both the prediction and the avoidance of bad consequences. Whether it is only bad consequences that are being thought about is a subject we can think about again with Holmes later in the week. But for the moment, the thing to understand is that a lawyer is not a hammer for which every problem is a nail. Though the public force may behave like that from time to time, though, as we shall see, equipping police cars with radios is a social force, what we mean is that society is a big and complex proposition, and even the simplest of questions, like whose charges are going to be reduced to disorderly conduct and whose will not, or who gets a death penalty and who gets turned into the state's star witness, even tiny little things like that, with tiny little consequences like death and life and imprisonment and poverty and getting the short stick or having your income double during the epidemic to multi-billions of dollars a year, all of those little tiny things depend upon a range of social processes, wheels and springs, and in such complex mutual adjustment that even a word in the right place, even a little particle of meaning, even a little fragment of language inserted where it needs to go can have remarkable, long-term, deeply, profoundly meaningful consequences. And we need to understand, if not the rules, then at least the dramaturgy of this structure. As we shall see in more detail in the next couple of weeks, what that means is that lawyers are adopters of every kind of knowledge about society, and they adopt that knowledge and they work the pieces of it in conjunction and in tension and in an effort to align and understand. They have multiple sources of information and multiple means of understanding. They use disciplines in an undisciplined or at least potentially chaotic way. I shall try over the next couple of weeks to show why it is, then, that a lawyer's theory of social action is based on many different forms of human understanding, biological understanding, intrapsychic psychological understanding of the individual mind, social psychological understanding of the influence of minds on minds, the forms of speculation about the material life of society, about the morphological life of society, about the meaning and interpretation of culture, about the process of historical understanding, about philosophical conjecture on the values that life either represents or turns away from, that we are generalists, magpies, stealing little bits of this or that and bringing them home and using them to fit out our theory that helps us to understand when we are sitting across the table from a prosecutor or an insurance lawyer or a thug or the president of the United States, what language might be inserted here to what effect. Always for the process of probing what can be changed, separated from that which will remain the same, from that which can only temporarily be subverted to that which might actually roll one big stone off the chest of the people who are always being pressed down. Our theory is a theory, then, of how to use other people's theories, combining them to get to some new view of the form of social life that most interests us. E.O. Wilson, one of the great biologists and biological thinkers of our time, who died just at the end of our last term, E.O. Wilson was a particular apostle of the importance in thinking in the Darwinian universe consiliently. Consilience is the form of argument or proof which brings together multiple strands independently to show that if a single explanation can be arrived at from multiple perspectives, each of those perspectives makes it stronger. As I stand here in my recording booth overlooking the Hudson River, standing on my increasingly inadequate aging person's legs, I find it useful to have a stick as well. Upon that third point, I come to rely for my balance as my seventh decade unrolls. And I am merely consiliently jumping, or not exactly jumping, staggeringly might be more the point. I am merely jumping together consiliently towards my goal, relying upon multiple legs to carry me there. When we prove a thing in court, we prove it multiple ways, at least if we believe we're going to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, or even by a preponderance of the evidence. We will carry in multiple forms of evidence, and we will hope that they preponderate together. Of course, the greatest of the Darwinian provers by consilience is, well, Charles Darwin himself, whose very way of going about the task of establishing what he called his new view of life was by thinking about orchids and coral reefs and earthworms, as well as the origin of the human species and the demonstration of emotions in man and animals. Vertebrates, he meant, but, well, I wonder sometimes what Charles Darwin would have made of my octopus teacher could he only have seen it on YouTube. This idea that we are engaged in consilient explanation of social process, that we use a little bit of psychology and a little bit of biology and a little bit of anthropology and a little bit of economic theory, if there is such a thing as economic theory, and if it wouldn't embarrass us to be seen in public using it, to bring to bear as many different ways of thinking about the social processes we mean to do something about as possible, so as to discover over time which of the many forms of explanation that we carry together have worked their way in, one could say parasitically, and to have taken us over, to have become part of how we think. I use all the time a little bit of history, a little bit of social psychology, a little bit of Geertzian interpretive cultural anthropology, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And in the end, I also read The Guardian, The New York Times, Politico, The Atlantic. And I am influenced by the thinking that I read there. Also by the constant exposure to young people learning how to practice law, as you are constantly changed by your exposure to them too. We would like to hope in a positive rather than in a negative direction, but this is law school and we simply can never be sure. The goal of this is our professional action. The goal of this is making things happen in society using words. There are a lot of things going on in our society. At the moment, it's a big one, and it's full of things all the time, and it's as wealthy and as powerful and as self-unreflective, amnesiac, and staggeringly unjust to itself as any society could be, but it's even busier doing things now than it is usually. A new American society, after Trump, after the epidemic, but with all the old burdens still strapped to its back and the bombs all ticking, is now being born. And the generation you are is going to make things happen in it using words. Not, I trust, by driving SUVs into protesters, right? Not using Twitter, but actual words strung together in actual sentences, spelled in a proofreadable way, possessing force and elegance, both, generated in a civilized manner. At any rate, that's what power thinks. It made it civilized. It determines what civilization is and what is savagery. But generated always purposively, for a purpose, knowingly, with multiple knowledges, in awareness of the desired consequences and for justice. It sounds like a big deal, but when you decompose the elements of that list into the different perspectives that we bring, our knowledge, our ingenuity, our anger, our civility, our suaviter in modo, fortiter in reiness, if you want to reify it, we act. It's good to study. This is a university. People study there, including sometimes law professors, but not so much. And to compile knowledges, like compiling libraries, is the most honorable of our activities as a human race. But we are, at the end of the day, and I say this as a second-generation university academic with two of the five advanced degrees in the five-person family from which I come. In all the various forms of university dependency and ivory towerization I have gone through since the time that I was born while my mother was studying for her doctoral orals, I have been too much a lawyer for too long to be prepared to sit in here and read and think and write without doing anything about the subjects of my thinking, my writing, and my pounding on the table with my bloodied hands. We need to do. That's why we're here. If you don't need to do, there are cheaper ways of becoming smarter and smarter and suaver than by going to law school. You want a license to get things done, don't you? You want leverage and power and insight to get things done, don't you? It is, after all, an appetite that must be satisfied. That desire to get things done. So getting things done that other people can't do means seeing things that other people can't see, creating music that other people wouldn't have written but can now hear. Making things happen in society using words means things that wouldn't otherwise have occurred if you hadn't been there to say what needed to be said to get them done. This is what we're trying to learn. Me too. I've been at it a long time, and I'm still trying to do it more effectively. I soon will come to the part of my lifetime, but I'm not quite there, in which I have no longer any primary power to get things done and only a secondary power to help you get them done. We are still practicing together. As I assured the New York Bar every other year, actively practicing law. Hence, I have to pay the fee, as you will have to pay the fee. We pay to be actively practicing law. Because, as I hope to be able to show you in the weeks we shall now spend together, actively practicing making things happen in society using words is a privilege and also a pleasure, an honor, but also a joy. To be unhappy in the law is to have had your value perverted. For what it is that we do, done as we ought to do it, creating for ourselves and for our clients and for our community justice that wouldn't have been there if we hadn't spoken up, is as deep a satisfaction as there is. And what stands in the way of that, whether it calls itself law school or placement or employment seeking or job fair or grades, what stands in the way of that is at once the enemy of happiness and justice and the truth of being who we are. Forward, then, to show that we can make what it is that we need, to have what it is that the society which has given us so much needs us to want. Talk to you soon.